All right, today we are going to be studying Genesis chapter 24, and we're going to look at the first nine verses, verse 1 through 9. And this is the beginning of the story of Isaac and Rebekah. Now, this is the first sermon on the topic of their marriage. But for the past two sermons, we have had a prelude to these. Two sermons ago, we described the characters in the story and their relevance. And in the story immediately prior, we discussed the motivator for Isaac to find a bride, and that motivator was the death of his mother. It spurred him to action on this. And in this sermon, we are going to discuss Abraham's plans for finding Isaac a bride and how he set those plans in motion. We will get to the actual marriage itself next week. Now, I'm excited, personally, to discuss Isaac and Rebekah's marriage, because their marriage is the first marriage described in the Bible. And so it provides the initial framework for what a marriage is and how it is accomplished. It's going to set the legal precedent for us. It's going to give us the first description of how this works. We've never seen two people be married. Now, we've seen married people. We've seen Abram and Sarai up close, right? We've heard about Lot and his wife, for example. But this is the first time that we're seeing two people coming together previously unknown to each other. So we're seeing their marriage from the beginning, and I like that. So I'm not going to read the passage. You're welcome to pause and look up the chapter. Again, it is Genesis chapter 24, and we're looking at verses 1 through 9. If you want to pause and read that, you can. And so here's what happens in the story. You can follow along with me. We read that Abraham is old. Now, based on his age, the year is about 2085 to 2087 after the creation. We know this because Isaac is going to marry at 40 years old, and we're able to calculate all that back. So Abraham is about 137 or 139 years old at this point. And we read that Jehovah has blessed Abraham in all things. Of course, Jehovah being the transliteration of the name of God being represented by all caps, Lord, in your Bible, more than likely. And so Abraham has become old. He knows that his son needs a wife, and so he has decided to find a bride for Isaac. And so he calls in his oldest and most trusted servant to set his plan in motion. Now, who is this servant? Traditionally, the servant is associated with Eleazar of Damascus. Eleazar is mentioned in Genesis chapter 15 as the heir to Abraham's house, since Abraham had no son at that time. Of course, he does have a son now. Now, it is not unreasonable to guess that Abraham's old and trusted servant here is the same servant as in chapter 15, but much could have happened in the 50-plus years since that time. Eleazar could have died, he could have been deposed, he could have run away. Any number of things could have happened. So the passage does not specifically say that this is Eleazar of Damascus, but it could be. We won't be presumptuous, we'll just suffice as the passage does to call him Abraham's servant. So Abraham, having called in his trusted servant, asks him to swear by placing his hand under Abraham's thigh. Now, this is a ceremony. This is sort of a way to seal the deal, if you will. Abraham and his servant aren't just talking about the possibility of what they're committing to here. They're actually committing to it. And they are demonstrating that commitment by doing something that they would not normally do in casual conversation. If they were just casually talking about finding Isaac a bride, you know, they might just chat about it and no one actually expects anything to get done. But once that hand goes under the thigh, you've sealed the deal. It's something you would never normally do. And so now Abraham is going to expect this certainly to be done. A modern equivalent to this would be shaking hands to conclude a deal. You might make a deal with someone, you shake their hand to say, hey, good deal, we've got this done. It's sort of a verbal contract. Of course, written contracts in those days would have been non-existent or very rare. We will see this again in scriptures one time. Isaac, later on, will have his children swear an oath to him in the same way, and we'll see that in Genesis chapter 47 at verse 29. So if you want to look that up, Genesis 47, verse 29, it's the only other time that we see this that I know of in the scriptures. So evidently, the tradition fell out of practice sometime thereafter. We never see it again. We might guess that Hebrews stopped doing this at the time that they were in the land of Egypt or some such thing. Now, the servant is asked to swear his oath, of course, in the name of Jehovah, the one true God. And God demands, we know from the Ten Commandments, obviously we haven't gotten there yet, but in Exodus chapter 20, God will demand that no one take his name in vain. Often that's misunderstood today to mean simply saying God's name flippantly or as a curse. Often people don't even know what God's name is. They think that God is God's name or Lord or something like that, when really obviously his name is Jehovah. Of course, that's the English transliteration of it. You might get back to the Tetragrammaton, the four Hebrew letters that actually literally spell God's name. But the point is that God does have a name, and what it means to take the Lord's name in vain is to swear falsely in God's name. You've said something vainly in his name, and you have broken your oath. So the servant is being asked here to make a very solemn oath, sealing the deal, like a contract, but more serious because you're doing it in God's name and don't take God's name in vain. So what is it that Abraham is asking the servant to do? Well, he has a request. Abraham utterly refuses to allow his son to marry a Canaanite woman. Now, we will note that Abraham's extended family tree is not filled with monotheists, and they do not know the one true God. Abraham is the first monotheist in a long time in this region. So what is it about their family? You can look at Genesis chapter 31, verse 19, by the way, which indicates to us that Laban, who is Rebekah's brother, keeps household gods. He keeps idols in his house. So we know that Abraham's distant relatives to whom he sends the servant are not monotheist people. They're not serving the one true God. So what is it about them? What is it that makes them so much better than the Canaanites? Abraham absolutely refuses to have a Canaanite wife for his son. What is it? Well, perhaps Abraham simply detests the Canaanites. He is from a different culture. He prefers the cultural practices of his people to those of his neighbors. Perhaps if you traveled to a foreign country, you would want someone who is English-speaking to marry your child or something like that. But more likely, I think the issue is that Abraham wants his family, and Isaac particularly, to remain distinct. Abraham and his son Isaac have a special promise from God, and the surrounding people don't. Abraham doesn't want his family to begin to mesh with the people of the land. He specifically wants to be sure that his people, who came from Ur of the Chaldeans, remain distinct from the Canaanite people. So that raises a question, because even if he wants to be distinct from the Canaanites, there are still other people that Isaac could marry. He could marry an Ishmaelite girl. He could marry a niece from one of Abraham's other offspring. He had many sons, as the song tells us. Why not marry one of those girls? Again, Isaac has a special promise. Abraham intentionally sent his other sons away and allowed them to intermingle with the people of the land. They are now essentially no different to Abraham. If Isaac was to marry the daughter of an Ishmaelite, then he would essentially be one of the people of the land, just like the Ishmaelites were mixed into the land. Isaac needs something special to make his lineage unique. He needs to stand apart from the people around him. Throughout Scripture, God's people are often called to be distinct, not only in our lifestyle, but also in our marriages. So let's look at a few examples. In Exodus 34, the people of God are exhorted to take the land of Canaan and not to marry Canaanite daughters. Quote, it says, their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. Indeed, marrying someone who is of a different faith from outside of God's people could lead to idolatry or to an abandonment of the true God. Deuteronomy 7, verses 3 through 4 reads, you shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons, or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. That is God's specific command to his people, the Israelites, that in taking the land of Canaan, they should not marry the people of the land. After the exile, after God's people were exiled into Babylon, and the Jews returned to their land, Nehemiah actually beat people and tore out their hair if he found them marrying non-Jewish people. You can read that in Nehemiah chapter 13. And Ezra, the great reformer and teacher of the law after the exile, annulled marriages to non-Jews. And that you can read about in Ezra chapter 10. Now, divorce and remarriage and how converts should behave themselves in mixed marriages once those happen is not the topic for today. We would get into that another day, so don't take Ezra's example as prescriptive for modern use. Let's wait until we get some New Testament principles behind that. Time doesn't permit it now, but we will discuss the issue another day. The point here that we're talking about is not taking foreign wives, not taking wives who are not believers. After Jesus' death, believers were exhorted not to marry unbelievers. Paul wrote, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness? That is from 2 Corinthians 6:14. So, again, it is still a New Testament principle. God's people are not supposed to be intermingled with the people of the land, so to speak. We are as different as light and dark. As God's people, we are a new nation, called to be distinct from the people of the world, and as such, we are commanded to take believing wives for our sons and to give our daughters to believing men only. And Abraham was wise enough to recognize the value of this with his son Isaac. And so this is what he asks of his servant. He asks him to go back to his home country, to Ur of the Chaldeans, and to find a wife for his son. Now the servant, before he can swear to do this, has a question about the oath. He says, what if the family is not going to send the girl back with me? What am I going to do then? Should I seal the deal on this marriage and then take Isaac there to be with her? Abraham's answer is, no way. Don't take my son back there. Abraham trusts in the promise that God has made him concerning the promised land, and he has firmly decided that his son will live to take this land. He knows what God has told him, and he is determined to obey. And in doing so, he will keep Isaac distinct, but also he will not send Isaac away. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10, tells us that Abraham always lived by this faith. Let's read Hebrews chapter 11, verses 8 through 10. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder was God. You see, when Abraham had arrived in the promised land, he lived a less than pleasant life. He stayed in the tents, he herded the sheep, and he did this because he had an eager expectation of something more for his son Isaac. He was looking forward to the city that had foundations, whose designer and builder was God. Abraham will ultimately die not seeing the fulfillment of this promise, but he has a hope, and because of that hope, he is still living for the promise. Hebrews chapter 11, if you read verse 15 and 16, it goes on to tell us that if Abraham had wanted to go back, he had the opportunity. And here the opportunity is. But having this opportunity to go back, to take his son with him, to find a bride for him, and to simply stay there, Abraham is bound and determined that he will press forward because he wants something better for his children. Abraham is a good example for us today, not only because he wants a good marriage for his son and because he wants a great promise for him, but because he demonstrates to us that we may not ever see the rewards of our good works in this life, but we will see them in the hereafter, if only we have faith like Abraham had faith. Our lives can be difficult. We can be beset with many difficulties. And we may do right in a world that continually does wrong and that harms us. And we might say, where is God? But God is there, and God is insistent that we will be blessed for our faithfulness. Don't grow weary of doing good. Continue to do good. Continue to look forward to an eternal reward, even if you can't see it yet. You are living right now in your tent, but you are looking forward to a city with foundations designed by God. Abraham's faith showed itself in the way that he lived. He didn't just talk about wanting the promised land. He made sacrifices for it. And he sacrificed such that he was willing to organize his entire life and his family around having the promised land. And I hope that those of you listening to me today will organize your life around serving God so that you can have the rewards that are to come. So in conclusion, we are to be different from the world around us. And particularly, we are to be different in choosing whom we and our children marry. And we are to obey God with a faith like Abraham had. Next time, we will discuss the servant's journey to find a wife for Isaac. For those of you who might be listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.